Welcome to CSAI. My name is John Reed. I am a research scientist at Blue Prism AI Labs. I'm joined by my co-host Roshan Aktash. Today we are going to discuss the data science surrounding the coronavirus pandemic. There are many interesting questions relating to the difficulty of data collection, data quality, data visualization, and modeling of the disease dynamics. These difficulties affect the accuracy of the data science, so we will ask how and whether it should inform public health policy. We are very happy to be joined by Kaiser Fung, a consulting data scientist, educator, and author. His two books are Numbers Rule Your World and Number Sense. He also publishes two highly regarded blogs. Junk Charts discusses data visualization methods and criticizes real-world examples. Big Data, Plainly Spoken, discusses how data and algorithms affect the society we live in. Kaiser is an alumnus of Harvard Business School, Princeton, and the University of Cambridge. He has written extensively about the data science of COVID-19. Welcome, Kaiser. How are you?
I'm great, and I'm very happy to be here with you guys and talk about statistics modeling and COVID.
For like the fifth time.
Well, that would be another podcast to talk about our technologies.
This is like the fifth take we are trying to record this episode. So hopefully this time, fingers crossed, we're going to get it done. Thanks, Kaiser, for joining us again.
Cool. Should we kick off then?
Yeah.
So just to kick off, so all the models we're going to discuss later are based on underlying assumptions and estimates of COVID-19 characteristics. One of those characteristics is the reproductive value R0, which tells us on average how many other people each infected person transmits the virus to. Can we know how accurate our estimates of R0 are?
Well, that's actually a great place to start, because trying to understand what R0 is going to actually tell your audience quite a bit. It turns out that a lot of the things that we measure out there, including this number R0, is something completely abstract. It cannot be directly measured. And it's basically a number that drops out of a statistical model, which itself is a simplification of the real world. So I actually spent the first chapter of the book Number Sense talking about something like that, which is the U.S. News ranking of American colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people make very important decisions, life decisions, based on, you know, which college ranked before which one. And it turns out that the entire ranking, as well as the metrics behind them, are inventions. Right, so there's no higher God out there who can tell us that, you know, is it really true that Princeton should be number one and Harvard should be number two? So if you think about a lot of the numbers around us, most of these metrics are surreal in this sort of way. So if you think about the R0, the real definition of R0, and it's been sort of corrupted by the need to explain it to the general public, but in the real epidemiological model, R0 is this basically unmeasurable thing. It is the total number of people that is infected by patient zero from the beginning of this person getting sick to throughout the period of infection. So until this person either dies or has recovered. So it's about that particular person, and it's at the moment in time when the entire population is susceptible and nobody is either immune or has been infected yet. So it's essentially a core quantity that drives the projections of a lot of these models, but it's one of those things where you will never get data to directly measure it. You can only infer it by measuring a number of indirect things. So most of the time, this number can really only be estimated after the epidemic is over. So if you know, you know, using the now sort of infamous antibody testing, you can measure how many people might have been infected and have become immune. So you kind of know the end state. You have some sense of the beginning state, so you can, in some sense, estimate the speed of that transmission, which is what the R0 is trying to measure. I think the first thing to realize about the R0 is that there's no such thing as correct because nobody knows what the correct number is.
Is that something we can find out only afterwards, perhaps, or not at all?
Yeah, if you find out afterwards, you can come up with a number, right? But we still face the problem where there's really no way to validate the number. What you can then do is to generate, based on that number, projections of the curves, right, or the types of curves that we've seen today. And then you can say, well, if those curves are somewhat approximately representing what we've seen, then maybe there's some truth to it. So it's basically a plug. And right now, while the epidemic is still happening, all of these estimates are based on even more far-fetched approximation strategies. So a lot of those data points are insufficiently or inadequately measured, and we already know of many problems with the data. So it's a bit of a wild west at the moment. However, I think we can come back to this theme a lot, which is that having something that is maybe approximately correct is better than literally just throwing things on the wall.
I mean, given that we could never know exactly what it was, could we know how close we can get to an estimate of R0?
I actually don't really think so in this particular situation. It's kind of like, going back to my analogy, even if you admit that nobody knows whether Princeton or Harvard should be number one or any of the other schools, can you really say what's the amount of error, if we put the ranking out there? I think that would be a very hard question.
Yeah, okay. I mean, so the ranking of the schools is like a discrete thing. But R0, that when they use it in these models, it's a continuous number. It can be, below one or above one. So obviously, if every person is infecting two other people, that leads to an exponential growth in the pandemic. Is there any sense in which we know whether we're in the right ballpark with R0, or are our estimates of it just doomed to be estimates we can't verify?
Well, I think it's the interaction between your R0, because basically these models have R0 as one of many assumptions. And they also have a particular structure that has been predefined, right? So that the field of epidemiology have over, when they study past epidemics, they have discovered that there's a certain pattern. So the model has a structure that mimics that pattern. And then it has a whole bunch of assumptions. Many of these assumptions have the nature of R0, where you cannot directly measure them. So you can put some estimates in there. And then there's also data fed into these models. The data is of variable quality and also relatively small amounts right now. And then out comes some projections. And then what happens is, based on the interaction between these assumptions and the data, you end up generating projections that you would hope will be approximately correct in terms of when you compare it to actual observed, let's say, reported cases or deaths. So there's a bit of a subjective judgment as to what is considered accurate enough. There are ways to validate this by holding back some of the data and making sure that your model is actually trying to project the future as opposed to just fitting the past. But it's still a bit of a craft as opposed to, with a little bit of science. I think that it would be hard to know until the epidemic have ended to really be clear, be clearer as to whether these numbers are correct. Also bear in mind that the modeling is complicated by the fact that the numbers are not just a fact of life and nature. There's obviously the virus that's spreading around, but there's also human factors and policies that affect these numbers, all the social distancing, all of the, wearing face masks and things of that type will affect, R0, which makes it even you know, harder to estimate.
I mean, the R0 value we've been talking about for like 10 minutes, and from what I gather, it's super difficult to estimate. Actually, I want to speak about this Imperial College report, which was using a bunch of estimates and assumptions, and R0 was one of them, as well as other things. I think there's about 30-something estimated or assumed factors in that report. So the science, obviously, in that report is very complicated, and it looks sound to me. But thinking about this many assumptions that go into those models, and also the, obviously those models were created early in the epidemic, right? Early in the pandemic, when the first 15 days of data was used from UK, for example. So it's easy to look back now in hindsight and say, oh, this was correct, this was incorrect. But what is your take on these models, like, which are very complicated, created by experts, but they depend on a lot of assumptions and parameters that are difficult to estimate?
I think you painted a very good picture of it, right? I think the judgment of these types of models must be made based on the context around which they were built, right? So that model was built at the very, very early stage of the pandemic. And I think in the UK at the time, as well as in the US, there were very few cases and maybe almost no deaths. Yeah. So the only data you have is requires extrapolation, right? Because things from China, maybe a little bit of data from Italy, those are extrapolations when you apply it to your own populations, because you know it's not like every country is interchangeable. So the way that I like to think about modeling is you have to understand that every model has really three things at play. One is the very rigid structure of the model, right? Some models have very strong structural features in them. In fact, most of the epidemiological models that are out there make an assumption of exponential growth. In other words, there's no data that you can feed into these models that will move it away from the exponential growth assumption because it's already built in there. Then you have a second set of things that we call parameters, which are basically assumptions, right? So while the model may assume exponential growth, how fast the exponential rate is something that is an assumption. And then you have data, right? So what happens is as more data comes in, the assumptions should play a lesser and lesser role in the outcomes. Mm-hmm. But at the very early stage, the assumptions are going to be much more influential than the data. And it's sort of a never-ending debate because you can complain that the models are making too many assumptions. But on the other hand, we also have recently learned over the course of the 2 months mm-hmm. that the data being collected are of very low quality. So if you feed in data with low quality and they override a lot of the assumptions, then you will end up with a bad model too.
By low quality, what do you mean? Can you expand that?
Yeah, so there have been many, many examples of why the data has been low quality. I think you can have multiple reasons for low quality. One would just be mechanical. So you may have reporting delays. You may have people simply failing to count certain things, right? Those are very mechanical. But there's also what I would call political sort of reasons for mm-hmm. some of the low quality issues. The primary driver of which is the way in which a country sets its testing policy. So the biggest issue from day one is the fact that there's no confirmation of a case or a death unless there is a test that confirms that the virus was there. And in countries that were very slow in ramping up testing, there will be severe undercounting for a very long time.
I see.
And then the other really big problem with the testing programs in most places, especially in the UK and the US, is the fact that there have been no movement behind at least having some portion of the testing be applied at random. When all of the tests are being applied to people who report severe symptoms, you have a severely biased data set, and that actually goes back to one of the reasons why R0 is very hard to estimate right now, is the fact that the definition of R0 actually requires that you actually have information about the general population, not about just the people with severe diseases. So a lot of the data quality issues also come from the fact that politicians and potentially some frontline medical workers are much more interested in solving the problem now as opposed to what most statisticians and epidemiologists are interested in, which is to think, you know, several steps ahead, for which you need data that goes beyond that small group that are sick.
I mean, I guess it makes sense, right? Because there's a limited number of tests available. So if you want, in one way, you have to do the firefighting. In the other way, there is maybe the longer term benefit of actually doing this random sampling. But obviously, if you have concerns about the health of the patients, you're going to prioritize the first one, right?
Well, it's a very classic trade-off in statistics and operations research, right? We call this exploration exploitation.
Yeah.
I think for most statisticians and data scientists, we tend to want to at least spend some time exploring, which is basically to learn about the unknowns. But in the case of this pandemic or in this emergency, the argument might be there for, you know, full-on exploitation, which is the idea that you should reserve all of your testing capacity for people who are sick right now. I think it's very debatable. As a statistician, I think that by not sufficiently spending any energy on exploration, we have severely restricted our ability to see the future. It's ironic that people are complaining to us that we cannot predict the future with any confidence, but I would say that a lot of the failure can be attributed to the fact that we don't spend enough time exploring. And one great way of exploring is to dedicate, you know, even a small amount of the testing capacity to do random samples of the underlying population. That will tell us a lot. In fact, that will tell us a lot about modeling the asymptomatic cases, right? The people who are not sick, who will not just show up to go get tested, but they have the virus and they're spreading it around.
I mean, that's a difficult compromise to make, isn't it? I mean, in terms of the sort of predictive qualities of the model, I mean, so in other fields, there's sort of well-established methods, maybe perhaps back-testing to sort of identify how good the predictions of the model is. But in the middle of this pandemic, I mean, are there any realistic strategies that people could use to sort of try and evaluate how useful these models are as we go along in the face of constantly changing public health interventions that are affecting the dynamics of the disease? And all of these sounds like tremendous difficulties to overcome at the same time as trying to evaluate how well your models are performing.
Yeah, I think you're right on the mark there. You know, I think that the fact that it's challenging shouldn't mean that people should not try to validate the models. There's well-established ways to backtest, to especially when the situation is still evolving. So what it creates a natural environment where you issue your projections for the next week, and then after the next week is over, you can go back and look at how good your projections were. And then you can always then build in factors to account for maybe changing policies and things of that type. So I think that should definitely be done. And I think that some groups are better at providing that information than others. That goes back to a very tricky issue. So if you put out a lot of information out there, then those types of studies can be done, and people have done those, and that's how they're making claims that certain models have not performed very well. I think when you do those studies, you have to be a bit more sophisticated, given that, one, the policies are changing all the time, and two, we know now that the data has lots and lots of problems with missing values and erroneous values and timing changes, right? So if you think about projections, when you have inconsistent reporting lag times, it's going to make the projections look very bad if you look at a day-by-day error rate. You know, you need to have more of a context under which you interpret the validations. But I think in order for us to build confidence in these models, we do need to pay attention to the validation. There's a lot of just fitting models to the data, or not even models, but fitting curves to the data. I think those particular efforts are in most need of validation. I have done even some basic validation, and what you discover is that they all fit the past data really well, but you know, within a few days, the errors are really quite shockingly large, especially yeah. those things that claim to show exponential growth. I think it's hard to see on a log scale how bad your projections are, but if you put it back into a linear scale, you can see that your projections are actually way off, you know, even a few days out.
So I'm just curious, are there any examples that you would hold up as the people, perhaps, or the groups you feel are taking this model validation most seriously?
Well, I think that in the US, the people from the University of Washington that supposedly have these models that our government had been using for a while, I wouldn't say they have done a whole lot of the validation themselves, but they provide enough information, and they also, crucially, they provide links to their prior reports, which means that somebody who wanted to, as an external party, and this has been done by other parties, so you can actually take what they have produced, and then you can do some validation yourself. I think that I really commend them for doing that. I think that there are many other groups that have currently, you know, made it very difficult to see what they've done. Usually, this is when they only keep the most recent version of their model out there. And also, even some of the, you know, I'm seeing a very disturbing trend lately, which is that I think people realize that the more information they put out there, the more potential critique they get from the community. And then some people have been holding back, like the antibody testing in the US. You know, I live in New York. They have paraded the results on our governor's briefings every day, but you will not be able to find a single scientific source for any of that data or any explanation or reports or preprints or anything about that. In those cases, it is impossible to validate anything.
Yeah, that is disturbing.
On this uncertain predictions, actually, we talked about a lot about the data and the modeling, right, and the problems with it. I was thinking these predictive models that we see every day and we are used to it now, it's a bit like the weather predictions these days. They're notoriously unreliable, especially on the longer future rather than the immediate future. My question to you is, like, do you think this is actually happening? Isn't this sort of dangerous that it's going to undermine the science in people's eyes?
Yeah, so I would approach it in two ways. One is that I hope that what people learn out of this is something that all modelers hold dear, which is the, you know, the saying that all models are wrong, but some are useful because modeling is ultimately a simplification of the world. So there's no hope that it will be fully correct. I also think that there should be some attention to the purpose of modeling. There are some models whose main purpose is to project the future. Like, for example, if you work for a company, you might want to project future revenues. In an established business that is actually a very well-defined function, and you can do it with very close accuracy because the business has a functional and stable business model, those types of activities are not likely to be accurate. Even for a business that is growing very fast and in the early stages does not have a stable model. So you don't want to use models for the purpose of projecting numbers in that way. So for the API models we're talking about here, I think the primary uses of these things are going to have to be setting high-level general public policy. We're really talking about pretty crude differences between, you know, things like what might be the shape of the curve, where's the approximately when the peak might happen, you know, things of that type. So that's more a proper use of this type of modeling than to try to say that every day you need to be able to project a number within, you know, X percent of the, you know, the real number. I think that that's an unrealistic expectation. In terms of the reception of models, that's a pretty interesting thing. I've learned over the years that it seems like the scientists are often blamed for everything. You know, it's like you put a well-reasoned projection out there, and of course you could be wrong sometimes, and then when you're wrong, it seems like the politicians love to point fingers at them. It's always curious why, on the other hand, you have lots of politicians saying all kinds of things, and we're hearing them a lot, most of which have no basis, right? It's sort of like a gut feeling. It's not even well explained, you know, why they believe in some treatment or other treatment.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that the public seems to be very tolerant of those types of mistakes. When they are proven to be wrong, it seems like there's not a whole lot of vitriol against the original decision there. So there's a little bit of asymmetry there. I think kind of leading to the fact that, you know, that situation in New York where we have now some science that is supposed to be behind these antibody testing results, but the science cannot actually be vetted by anybody because they're not released.
I mean, what you said earlier about this double standard of how people treat the word of scientists and also politicians, I guess that's about people's perception, isn't it? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, science is usually something absolute in people's eyes, something you can trust. Whereas politicians, sometimes you know that they are not, they may not be telling the entire truth and whatnot. Apart from the politician side, do you think there's a problem with that way of looking at science, like something absolute?
I think somehow we have trained, it's a little bit of a catch-22 because somehow we have trained our, I think the public and even in maybe the certain parts of our education system seems to train people to think that science is an absolute field. That's true of certain formulas, you know, like, you know, things like gravity and things, you know, the apple always falls down. But in a lot of social sciences and a lot of data sciences, there's a stochastic component to this and things don't always happen. If you do the same thing 10 times, they don't always give you the same outcome. And that's part of the fascination of this field. Like we are modeling these types of uncertainties. But I think that the perception of the general public to those types of probabilities and chance events is perhaps not there. And, you know, a part of it is really the job of scientific communications.
Yeah, I understand.
As also as it comes to the public, I think the other thing other than the stochasticity is the fact that we always try to point out, you know, almost like a self-critical thing where we say, you know, this holds under these assumptions or these holds under certain, with certain limitations. And I think oftentimes in the very hyper-political environment, anytime you claim there's a limitation, it's been seized upon by certain people who don't like the outcome that you're projecting and made into a big deal when it oftentimes is really small.
Yeah. You can see that sort of some of this modeling, it's sort of people like certainty, don't they? So, I mean, if you go back to, I think right at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a model on Medium that was quite influential. And that was a guy who didn't have a background in epidemiology. This guy, Thomas Pueyo, he put a post out there, which was fitting curves to the data. And it was a very alarmist post, right? So he was saying everybody should take action now. In terms of the sophistication of his model, it wasn't particularly sophisticated, but it did predict bad things would happen if we didn't take any action. All the assumptions were implicit in the model, weren't really explicitly stated. And these are all sort of concerns that we've talked about through this episode. But on the other hand, people read his post. They believed his maybe overconfident predictions about what would happen, and it changed people's behavior. So I know in our office, some of my colleagues were very much in favor of working from home after reading his post. So, I mean, given that the statistics perhaps weren't perfect and the predictions were overconfident, I mean, his model was tremendously useful in affecting behavior. How would you reconcile that with the need for as accurate modeling as possible?
I think that's a perfect example of, in terms of catalyzing action, how you present your results, and I guess the platform that you have becomes actually potentially even bigger factor than the actual contents of what you're delivering. And that's sort of, unfortunately, that's sad, depends on your point of view, but a pretty good reflection of what real world is like. I think that a lot of us scientists would love it if we present our data and our evidence and that would be the end of the debate, but it oftentimes is the beginning of it. And, you know, my personal opinion is, and I think this is a good example of it, to have more influence on policy, scientists really need to adopt some of the tactics that are used out there in terms of influencing public opinion. I think that so long as we believe that, you know, our recommendations are, you know, very well supported by the science and our modeling, right, and we're presenting a point of view, I think that when we are extremely careful, we are often slow to the game, right? So then you have poorly supported arguments that are out there floating around already in sort of that vacuum. I think timing is one issue. And then also many politicians and many people, like including that particular blog post that you talked about, uses a tone of certainty. That doesn't mean that they have certainty. In fact, they have a lot of uncertainty. In fact, there are a lot of more problems if you look carefully at what's been written there compared to some of the more sophisticated approaches. But it's that tone of certainty that that people have reacted to. A lot of our scientists, especially the more careful scientists, would like to inform the public of the potential limitations of their conclusions and some of the assumptions that went into it, and provide caveats for not trusting it too much. I think that's a central contradiction, right? Because we want people to trust us while we are actually telling them why they shouldn't trust us completely. in a way, right, you can say statisticians are possibly the worst because we always provide margins of error. But then we, in our field, we think that when we provide the margin of error, you should trust us more. But I think the general public may be having a hard time reconciling those. That.
But Kaiser, how do you get people to act if you don't speak in certain terms? This is a bit of a double-edged sword, isn't it? If you communicate that uncertainty, which is very high, I mean, how are you going to get people to act?
That's exactly the contradiction we're talking about here, right?
Yeah.
Now, I was attending a webinar last week and somebody is putting out some toy model, right? They acknowledge that this is not a good model, but they were showing some projection of depths from like 20 to like 20,000 or something, right? Mm. So it's sometimes scientifically it reflects the high level of uncertainty and the bad quality of the data and everything else, right? But on the other hand, it's very hard. It's like going back to the weather forecast, right? When you tell people that, you know, there is a, whatever, a 25% chance of rain, like that's already stated with precision. And even then you don't really know how to react to that. But if you then look at the uncertainty around that, you know, the actual model might say something like, you know, between 15% and 35%. That's yet another layer of uncertainty to it. And I think that's a big issue. I think that the reality is, I think a lot of people are looking for that simplicity, right? They are hoping that there will be a simple answer, but life is complex. And
there is no easy answer.
And I personally, over the years, have tended to also, you know, realize that I think there's a difference between sounding confident in your conclusions while your conclusions actually is a range of possibilities, right? I think that there's oftentimes, maybe that's the key, is that there's a difference between sounding unsure about your work versus sounding confident about your work, but the work actually conveys not absolute perfect knowledge, if that makes any sense.
I think this coronavirus pandemic is really a perfect example of that, isn't it? Because you've got very serious epidemiologists at one level going all the way through to amateur data scientists who want to model what's going on. And you have a whole range of sort of abilities in between and a whole range of people who are sort of overconfident in how they're modeling what's going on. So, you know, if you wanted to find an example to look at that sort of phenomenon, I think coronavirus might well be a perfect one.
Yeah, in one of my books, I think there was a Number Sense, I sort of had worried about what I would call maybe potentially a dark age for science as a result of the widespread collection of data, this called big data movement, the accessibility of data to almost everybody, the continuous improvement of tools to allow people to publish and to do all kinds of analysis and publications. It creates this really difficult situation for careful scientists, because on the one hand, I think that allows a kind of mass checking and validation of the science and potentially speeds up the improvement of the scientific process. But on the other hand, there's not enough time in the world for the scientist to really respond to every possible critique of the work. Some of them are, you know, potentially more on the mark, some of them are less. And it creates a situation where you can have a lot of different analysis and conclusions that are supported by a varying level of degrees of data and evidence to coexist. And we're already seeing, you know, both here and I think in climate science, that people will gravitate to the particular model or the particular set of data that tends to confirm their core beliefs. So I think it's still unclear in my head what may happen to science. I think there's some worry that this big data could eventually kind of make science really confusing. But, you know, there's also benefit, again, to, you know, having all of that data and having more eyes on it. I think it's been very confusing just because people have certain views, right, because of the uncertainty, impossibility of predicting what actually would happen. Then people develop very different contrasting views of the world. And as is normal human behavior, you tend to be attracted by the data and evidence that supports your views. That adds to the noise out there.
I mean, that's confirmation bias, right? We are all guilty of it to some extent.
Yeah, and it's actually, you know, even in the, you know, and confirmation bias is a very potent enemy. And I think anybody who works in science and statistics knows that it's not really avoidable. And even if you are very ethical, you could fall into those traps. My current favorite example of this kind of thing, it has to do with the Stanford antibody study, where after the first preprint came out and people pointed out that your result is really extremely sensitive to your estimate of the specificity of the test that you're using. And to prove the specificity, typically you have to go find external samples of data, pre-COVID blood samples, to be able to establish what the rate of false positives truly are. So in the initial study, they found basically just 30 samples of blood to establish that number, which is way too low. But now you're in this confirmation bias issue because now you know that you need to get to a certain sample size to convince your critics that your estimate is accurate enough. So you're out there searching for more samples from other labs and other places of these sort of pre-COVID blood. And it's almost like a go sick situation where you get, once you get to a certain point, you have established your proposition, right? So how do you, as a scientist, how do you prevent, I mean, you're already in that situation. How do you prevent that? You can't, right? And what happened is some of the labs that took part in the validation quit after they saw that the test wasn't doing that great, was not very accurate. So they may have withheld the data. That itself is a confirmation bias that has nothing to do with you, right? Like if the other party decided to quit and take their samples that have negative values, right, not proving a proposition out of the sample, that affects, you know, that is a version of confirmation bias too. So it's a very tricky situation and it's manifesting itself a lot. And we'll see, I think I can predict that as we kind of go through a lot of these studies with the treatments about the vaccines, that becomes a very big issue because everybody wants to have that vaccine and treatment. Everybody wants a happy ending to this. So it's very easy to fall into those type of traps.
Yeah, it's a hugely complex issue. I mean, yeah, it's been very nice just to have some sort of overview of some of the problems through the data, the modeling, and the how it affects the policy and behavior at the end of the day. I think what we'd like to say, Kaiser, is thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And I don't know whether we got more questions now, given that we've given that, you know, you've given us so much food for thought on a lot of these different angles. We got a little bit away from coronavirus and the sort of difficulties of data science in general at some point, and it's just nice to have your take on this whole coronavirus.
Well, thank you for asking, you know, those hard questions that I think people ought to spend time thinking about. And I think as the first wave dies down, we have plenty of time to hopefully to prepare better for the next wave. And I think that I'm hoping that the discourse that's happening here, as well as various outlets, social media, hopefully will provide people a much more solid background to make their own personal decisions, right? Because there's political decisions, there's also personal decisions that you make regarding your own behavior. And hopefully we have learned something from this first wave, and hopefully we won't see a worse second wave, you know, goes back to the model seems to all be saying that this second wave is inevitable. We'll have to see if this will be validated by reality.
I mean, hopefully we're going to be able to suppress it better this time at least. But yeah,
exactly.
Thank you, Kaiser. Thank you for joining us. It's been awesome to have you around a second time.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.